Okay, I think, believe it's time to get started. Oh, that's Alex. Well, in a very timely sequel to the last few lectures, the Europeans successfully launched the first two Galileo satellites today. So we can now say that Galileo is at least off the ground. So that's very exciting for global positioning systems. Okay, today we're going to talk about navigation. In the last lecture we looked at more traditional navigation. We looked at navigation in the sense of how we get around on the surface of the Earth, how we use things like radar at sea, and how we use techniques like resection on maps to be able to navigate around in the landscape. But these days, much of the navigation that we do is on the World Wide Web and the Internet. And so what I'm going to talk about today is really two very new things as far as mapping and cartography is concerned. One is a new industry that's just really still taking off. It's called location-based services. I'll talk about it in just a minute. It's really enabled by GPS, the chips, the system, the three-segment system that we saw earlier this week. And then web mapping, the fact that we can now produce more webs more maps on the Internet every day than were previously printed over a decade and then used is a very effective means of distributing cartography. So let's get started. What is location-based services? Well, there's a fundamental difference between a phone with a GPS chip in it or with the ability to locate itself from cell towers than a dumb first-generation cell phone. So what are LBS? Services developed and distributed by wireless means and others to provide information that is specific to a location. So you can think of it as like, almost like encrypted information, and there's something going to unlock it. What's going to unlock it? Being in a particular place. So actually being located somewhere. We've done this for years. If you go to a website, let's say, and you're purchasing something, you type in your zip code, that locates you down to a fairly small region on the Earth. But it's not really using your position. So if you were in Europe and ordered something from your home address in the United States, it wouldn't record the fact that you're in Europe. Some examples, requesting nearest businesses or services, receiving alerts, or looking for a friend. We're going to look at each one of these in turn. Google introduced this concept a good 7 or 8 years ago now with something that was originally called Google Local, the ability to structure searches based upon where you were or where your current location was. So what has it enabled? What's taking place now that wasn't happening before? Well, resource tracking, extremely important. I'm going to go over some examples there. Of how we can keep track of things rather than people quite easily using the technology. And then the tracking people, finding someone or something, becomes much easier if they're tagged and if we know their geographic location. And then we have two different types of notification, which primarily so far have been exploited by advertising, but have a lot more potential uses as well. So proximity-based notification means receiving something that's specific to where you are. So let's say I'm walking down the street carrying my iPhone and I happen to walk past a pizza parlor that has a $5 off sale that day. That store can detect my presence and text me a discount coupon that I can perhaps even just walk into the store and show it on the screen and get the discount. That's proximity-enabled push notification. And we can also have actuation. Things happen when you're in a particular location that wouldn't happen otherwise. These I'm going to discuss in a little bit more detail. So the simplest example, the one that's been around the longest, Google Local morphs into Google Maps, and now you probably noticed that Google knows mysteriously where you are. If you travel and start using it in a hotel room, it knows that you're in the city you've just moved to. So we can search businesses. Here is Google Local. I don't even know if it's still in the Google list. It might be. So we can type in Isla Vista, California, and we want a surfboard repair shop. It's going to find one and direct me to it. And the search results here are going to be structured not the way they usually are within Google, which is by their index strength of relationship, the similarity to your request, Instead, they're structured by the geographical distance between where the query was made and where the target is. Okay, so these firms will become listed, all be marked on the map. Only one came out in this search. This has taken over. It's happened without you even realizing it, but you probably noticed geography beginning to creep in. Location-based services includes spatially enabled networks. Okay, so spatially enabled networks, a good example of one, is this system. You probably noticed these strange cut marks in the street pavement all over the place. What's happened here is that somebody's cut the line out here and put a cable into the tarmac, and here they've put a coil, there's a loop. These are inductive coil loops that can detect when a car drives across, or actually when anything drives across. What happens? Well, that signal goes back. You notice there's one for each lane, and there are two in each lane. That means if I've got two, I can tell how fast the car is driving and the fact that it's a car. And which lane it's in, that information goes back to one of those mystery boxes beside the road, which then digitally encodes the information and sends it out across the internet. In California, all of the data is collected on a server at UC Berkeley, and then is immediately served back out again across the internet. So location-based services web providers can pull that information down. It's posted every 15 seconds. So I can pull that information down and then put it out again in a mapping context. So this is Bing Maps, but almost any one of the services, Google will do the same thing, can put out information like how fast the traffic's moving on the 405 in LA, or whether or not there are traffic incidents that can be posted with information on them, the same information they use on radio stations to announce that, you know, it's all clear on the freeways this morning, or there's an ambulance responding to a fire at such and such an address. Okay, enormously valuable information. It becomes useful because it's sensed in the environment, collected, pulled together, and then redistributed via maps. Okay, finding things or finding people, remarkably simple. This is a GPS-enabled cell phone. All the third and fourth generation phones usually have GPS chips in them. In fact, it's now been mandated that every cell phone sold in the United States must have a GPS chip in it by, I believe it's 2018 or something like that, for the very good reason that almost all emergency response calls are now made by cell phones, and we don't have any fixed location without some location device. So if you're carrying a phone around, somebody knows where you are pretty much all the time. You have very little geospatial privacy when you're carrying a cell phone. These things can first became noticed by the very similar technology being placed in cars. This is called the LoJack system. A LoJack is a way of hiding inside your vehicle a geospatial sensor that, if your car is stolen, can be activated and the signal can be retrieved and you can find out exactly where the car is and go and get it back. So we're locating all sorts of things can be done relatively straightforwardly. The technology to do this is coming way down in price, and it's getting smaller and smaller. We've reached the point now where something as small as what looks about the size of a sticker on a car could be used for geocoding it. In addition to that, we have other location technologies. If you remember my critique of GPS, we talked about the problems due to multipath error. We looked at the problems that concrete or buildings absorb the signal, since it's in the microwave, and we can't get it indoors or underground or underwater in any of the places we'd like to be able to identify where people are. Well, we have alternative techniques that work in those areas. Remember the radio frequency direction finding that we also covered in the last lecture? Well, the same technology can be used in what's called an RFID tag. So this is radio frequency identification. In this particular case, it's being used in a hospital, but it can be used over fairly large areas. So what do? We issue everybody an ID tag that is electronically sensitive. In fact, it's broadcasting your location to a set of receivers located throughout the building. So now if I'm sitting at the reception desk and I need Dr. Smith, I just simply pull him up on the screen. I know exactly where he is, which room he's standing in at any given time. They can locate people, they can locate animals, they can locate a whole bunch of different things. I briefly mentioned this when we were talking about GPS, but this is just one example. I pulled this one out because of the crazy name, Blade Runner Jackets. These are sold in the United States, in the United Kingdom, but increasingly we're seeing geospatially identifying or location technologies being put into clothing and the objects that you would buy in a store. This is just the tip of the iceberg, believe me. Pretty soon things like computers and high-value items, perhaps even appliances, will come with basically logs of data that are continuously monitoring not just where they are, but how they're being treated, whether or not they're working correctly, so that you can, you know, get a coupon for $10 off a new toaster just before what yours is about to give out. That is pretty much happening right now. Blade Runner jackets are designed for people who go up in the mountains and go outdoors or go skiing, and these have embedded GPS, not just so that you can see where you are at any given time, which you indeed can, but also often other people can see where you are by subscribing to an internet-based service that is linked into the tag in the jacket so that they can follow where you are. And mom and dad could watch the kids on the ski slope and make sure they're not going on those diamond runs or whatever it is. Again, these have become enormously popular. There's a company in the United States that makes a round of children's backpacks that have GPS capability built in so that you can just simply watch your kids walk to school every day and make sure they're safe. So we begin to see this wearable computing aspect coming about because it works. So this one's offering worldwide tracking up to 4 meters resolution. You can really see where everybody is. RFIDs are everywhere. When coupled with GPS, they're enormously powerful. This is an evidence room in a police department, and every piece of evidence has been tagged with an RFID tag. So if I need to retrieve the file for a particular case, I just set it on my receiver, and I go searching for it, and it locates me. So I just walk straight to the record that I need by using this technology. This is pretty much what the labels look like now. They're just electronic circuitry behind a tag, so it's literally just a stick-on tag. These can be put on boxes, so here's a layout of a building with equipment being tracked throughout the building. One place you will always find GPS chips and RFID tags is on containers. Pretty much every container as it travels around the world is continuously monitored in terms of where it is and often what the condition is, whether it's wet, whether it's getting too hot. All of these things are tracked. So every one of these containers is being tracked. In fact, the Transportation Research Group in the Department of Geography here has a long-term contract with the Department of Transportation looking at the movement of vehicles by the movement of containers in the Port of Los Angeles and Long Beach, and figuring out how to improve the flow of traffic and how to reduce the air pollution that happens when trucks stand still for too long. And, of course, we can tag animals. This guy is probably monitored from birth until when he finds his way into the hamburger factory. And many other animals are monitored, too. Perhaps if we'd had monitors on those 40 Bengal tigers, we wouldn't have had to shot them. One place where location-based technologies have literally changed the game is in agriculture. In fact, there's a new type of agriculture now we call precision agriculture. The old-school agriculture, you planted your crop, you fertilized it, you watered it. Now, when you plant your crop, you plant a monitor with every single plant, or at least in every row of crop, and that crop's continuously sending back information about the amount of nutrition available, about the water content of the soil, the fertility, and how much light it's receiving, and so on. So now if I want to go and irrigate, I just irrigate where it's needed, or I use quantities of water that are proportional to the needs of the plants. If I want to go and fertilize, I don't just blanket fertilize, which of course immediately runs off and pollutes the water system. I can just put the fertilizer in exactly the spot where it's needed. So these technologies can save enormous amounts of money, in fact in the billions, just here in California. Some of the technologies, the geospatial technologies, found their way in. Here's a high-end GPS locational unit mounted on a tractor. And inside of it, we've got data that's come in from direct measurements about probably moisture, surface moisture within this field. So we can now drive this tractor to exactly the spot where the soil moisture is at the highest or the lowest. We can also link rather complicated pieces of machinery up to these and now we don't even need a person in them because you can just control them robotically, have them, you know, watch your harvester going across the fields, making perfect turns every time. Also in aircraft, so if we've got a helicopter or a light aircraft that we're using for spraying or deploying pesticides, we can use that same information with these navigation systems so that we get things right. Big growth area. In fact, one of the most lively conferences I ever spoke at was a precision ag conference where they were using GPS in ways I've never seen before. Just incredible levels of accuracy and precision. Services provide that sort of link the internet and sort of pull requests. I've got a whole bunch of, here's just one of them, there are many. This one is a phone service that allows you to, in this case, go to, say, a theater or go to UCLA, in this case, and the resources that I might want to find there are now arranged in spatial order on the telephone. So I can do a spatial-based query with this and get immediate results. And we can do the opposite, pull technology. So let's say I'm following the World Series very closely, but have to lecture during the World Series games or something like that. I can have the results texted to my phone in real time, so I know that a run's been scored. I'm not particularly interested in the World Series this year because the Yankees are not playing. But there is a Texan team, you know, so we always like Texas to lose. Push technologies, I can receive information, but I can also post it back again. So increasingly you're finding things like online guides. So here's the ability to, let's say, find an unusual building that I don't know about. I'm a tourist. So I can, let's say, snap a photograph of it in my cell phone and then use that photograph in a web search to pull up the wiki page that covers that particular building. Or perhaps just by my current location, retrieve the fact from a city map, and then look at the entries for the components I want to see. Here's a system operational in San Francisco. That's again, it's a push system. It's a so-called volunteered geographic information system. So here, the users are providing the data, just like say on any of the Yelp, where you're providing reviews. Here, we've got people who are encountering things, are posting messages to other people. So this person's posted a graffiti, I assume is their name, but their post is, watch out for pickpockets. There are a lot of them here in that particular location. We talked about this last time when we were talking generically about the technology surrounding GPS. Probably the biggest and the most deployed is in-vehicle navigation systems. Very few cars these days go without these. And if you go to somewhere like Taiwan or Hong Kong, it's 100%. Every single vehicle on the street has one of these on the dashboard. And you can see at night because they're all glowing in color. Simple systems like this that are often added after the fact, OEM equipment, or sometimes they're installed directly into the car when you buy it. And they have a whole series of techniques, touchscreen, navigation. Often they do voice encoding, so they'll speak the names of places, or you can talk to them to program them. Often they have quite interesting things, like the one I have. As you speed up, it figures that you're moving faster from the GPS signal, so it sort of zooms out the map, because it figures that you're not so much interested in exact detail of every street. When you slow down again, it zooms in, so that you've got you can see the details. Some of them give really simplistic directions, you know, turn or veer right in half a mile. Mine is particularly useful in that it knows all the the yellow marked exits. The way you get in that lane, you have to exit right or exit left. It'll warn me two miles ahead, so I can get into the right lane of traffic. It's very useful. Some of the things that they do that are extremely useful, most of them now will allow you to speak the directions rather than just have them come up on the screen. So turn right on State Street and advance turns in advance. Most of them update via the internet, In the old style, you simply pull the memory card out of them. It just looks just like the memory card in your camera. You put it into your computer and you can download all the updates to the map. If you forget to do that for a while, it can be a little problematic because new streets are getting built all the time, different construction projects, closed bridges, and so on. But that's increasingly being done in real time. So the car itself is connected to the internet or connected to wireless, and it's downloading its corrections as you need them. All right, in other words, as I drive into the vicinity of a place where I might need those updates. They're interconnected now with cell phones, so we can use the cell phone service as a service to download information. That means we can download things like traffic, real-time traffic, to these guys. Some of them have the ability to update the map and share the information. So let's say you notice that a bridge is out. You can report that back to TomTom or Nokia or whoever it is running the system, and now that will be broadcast back as a correction so everybody else can benefit from your observation. Proximity search, they can be extremely handy. You can turn on modes like, I'm getting tired, where's the nearest motel that's under $100 a night, let's say, or where is the nearest motel that allows dogs? Those kinds of searches are very, very useful. The one I use most is where's the nearest gas station. Unfortunately, they don't post the prices. A lot of times we do directions too, so we'll say we want to navigate to a landmark or to a city or to a particular street address. We can program that in. It solves the least cost path or the least time path to the location and starts navigating right away. And there are now bike versions, so you can get the GPS for your bicycle that knows all about the bike paths and shortcuts and things like that. And there are now increasingly pedestrian versions that have meaningful information for people who are walking, because the different set of priorities and safety necessary when you're walking with a GPS. Number of services that provide maps over the internet is just staggering. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And most of them are new companies that didn't start in the mapping business. This one did. Rand McNally has been in the atlas and mapping business for a very long time, actually since the 1920s. And they have a website that will do the simple things that you need to do, like get directions from Santa Barbara to LAX or whatever it might happen to be in this particular case. So a lot of good examples of services that provide directions, just as a list, the way you might use them in your car rather than as a map. These are fairly common. And then, of course, driving directions, getting driving directions from A to B. Here's the same thing, Santa Barbara to LAX, put into, then we've got a route summary up here. It estimates the time and the distance. It's kind of fun to put in, say, New York City to Los Angeles and see how long it takes to compute and where it tells you to go. Increasingly, I've found that when you're going long distances and there's a choice, that's not going to make a heck of a lot of difference. It'll ask you which major route you want to choose if you're crossing, say, an entire state. Okay, the list goes on and on. These are some highlights I thought I'd just cover for you. Rand McNally gives download driving directions. You're able to download maps. You can add multiple stops. So if you want to, say, drive across the country, but you want to stop at these five places on the way, it'll allow you to do that with multiple stops. It has real-time traffic updates. It has construction information. Yahoo Maps, another good one. They're the same thing. They'll give you driving directions, and they use the same inertial coil traffic information that everybody else uses. MapQuest has been around for a very long time. It's one of the older services. Allows you to find places, gives you maps, driving directions, and gas prices, so you can figure out where the cheaper places are to buy gas. You can choose between satellite maps or air photos. You can display addresses and look at businesses and services. Google Maps, we've talked about many times in class, allows you to to cut and paste links. So once you've found a place anywhere on Google Maps, you can sort of get the tiny URL for that, copy it and paste it, say, into an email. So if you want to tell everybody how to get to your house for a party, look your house up on Google Maps, post that, or email it to everybody. Now they can click on it, go to Google Maps and get directions, personalized directions to your house from theirs. We're going to discuss Google Maps in a little bit more detail. Google Maps is quite unique because it has its own API, its application development interface, that is XML compliant, and it has its own programming language called the Keyhole Markup Language, or KML. And KML files are all over the internet. You can find them very easily, and those usually locate things or sometimes draw things on maps. You can put these in other web documents, which makes them quite flexible. Very old service, now since bought up, Multimap, which maintains its website. It was bought up by Microsoft, and it remarketed it as Bing Maps late in the game compared to Google. Multimap was most popular in Europe. It really was a pretty nice user interface. National Geographic has something called the Map Machine and has partnered with Google Earth to put the entire content of the National Geographic magazine and all its photographs and articles geolocated onto the internet. And MapBlast is now no more, but it's now part of MSN. It's been bought up by Microsoft since. But it has a very nice feature called MapBlast Line Drive, which I want to talk about in just a second. One thing I haven't really mentioned here is the fact that, speaking of geospatial enabling, an iPhone or even most digital cameras these days, without you knowing it, it's imprinting a geotag or the location of where you're taking a photograph into the photograph itself. So if you ever upload all your, through iTunes, or say all your photographs that you've taken on your iPhone, if you pull up Google Earth and look at them, they'll suddenly be in the right location. They'll move to the location where the picture was taken. Very nice feature. Oh, here's MapBlast. No longer, since 2002, bought up by Microsoft and sort of disappeared into Bing. But it had this wonderful feature that I've never seen duplicated elsewhere, which was that it would give you something simpler than a map, but slightly more complex than simple turn-by-turn directions. So it would take your drive and reduce it into a series of legs. This is just like those dead reckoning diagrams we were looking at in the last lecture. So we've got distances and approximate bearings, street names and times, just as we would have if we were navigating a boat along here. We navigate ourselves through the street network by using these techniques. It's kind of ridiculous to even say this now, but here's Google Maps. You can pretty much find anything you want in Google Maps. It's very simple and easy to use. The data that it's pulling from, much of it's in the public domain, came from the agencies like the U.S. Census Bureau, but some of it's proprietary. So you often see lots of different copyrights appearing at the bottom here. So this is copyright Google, map data from Navtech and other sources. So all these companies are clearly linked in and working together. And we can do a map image hybrid. We can just look at the image background, in which case we're usually pulling imagery from the United States Geological Survey's Digital Orthophoto Quadrangle program, but sometimes higher resolution satellite data or occasionally aerial photography that's been purchased and mapped. Remember, Google doesn't own this. They don't own any satellites. They're just paying the licensing fees to use it from other agencies. So here we put the roads over the image, and this, what I call this an IMAP. It's an image map hybrid, and this is, I would argue, this has become the most popular form of cartography. It's what most people want to see. Somehow it becomes credible when the image is there, and suddenly you start doubting the lines. Whereas, in fact, the lines have been produced with a great deal of precision, and the image sometimes hasn't. Here's a nice feature that was in the old Multimap before it became Bing Maps. So here I am in London. This is the River Thames. This is HMS Belfast, a permanently moored museum there in the Thames River. This allows you to go to another map source and then put the other map behind it in transparent mode. So most people that travel around in London are familiar with the ABC maps, which are sort of commercially available. This allows you to integrate the image with the map and see the two, actually slide the slider backwards and forward and fade one in and the other one out. Here's the MapQuest site. I should save these. These are going to be historical documents someday. MapQuest obviously links maps into a lot of things. Increasingly now, just as you see images appearing as a result of a search in Google, now you're increasingly seeing maps appear as part of an ordinary search of the internet. So obviously maps have enormous communicative power. This is out of the National Geographic map machine. Here we have obviously a lot less detail, but tied into a whole bunch more interesting types of data. Here's Bing Maps. At that time, it wasn't particularly well populated, but it does. Bing Maps does support search around features that you wouldn't necessarily find other way, including images. Bing is focused primarily now on three-dimensional modeling and on oblique views. So you're not just seeing the street view. You can sort of, it's not quite an air photo. It's not quite an overhead satellite view. Just to show you that it happens all over the world, here's the Cairo equivalent in Egypt, where we can see features here and go to them on the map. Notice that Arabic reads right to left, so your legend is always is backwards there, or it looks backwards. Once you've got all this information available, you can do all sorts of amazing things. A service that has come about that really sort of owes its existence to the internet is Zillow. If you've never played with Zillow, it's dangerous the first time you sort of spend your hours just looking things up. Zillow is fed by the real estate industry. So Zillow allows you to go down to the parcel level. So it contains the parcel map for every piece of property. It's the cadastral map, if you remember, from way back from week two. It's got other line information, but it allows you to look at properties. So we've got different categories here. Properties for sale, properties that are recently sold, that are sort of associated with the market. So we can go to any particular property, click on it, zoom in, or look up a street address, and we can see the long-term fluctuation in the price of the neighborhood or the individual property. We can see what the current assessed value is, what the taxes are for every single property in the United States. Really quite extraordinary. Here's Yahoo. Again, just simply allows you to integrate imagery of maps and post features. All of these things feature a tremendous amount of advertising, obviously. Okay, now we reach some of the less well-known but very important services that are out there that are actually being tapped by things like Google and Bing. So this is the Census Bureau's gazetteer. What's a gazetteer? It's, if you flip to the back of any atlas, you'll find a list of all the places that are in the atlas and their locations, usually their latitude and longitude. In atlas, you also might have the page number on which to flip back to see the map and sometimes a grid reference to the location. So this means that you need that if you're doing maps on the fly on the internet, you need some kind of service that begins with a place name and ends up with a location in latitude and longitude or in some kind of grid system. That's called a gazetteer. And we have two excellent examples here. The one that's kind of pool shared between the Census Bureau and the USGS, which operates the Board on Geographic Names, which actually is the sort of legal authority around place names in the US, into which we can type a place name here. We answer a few questions about what it is, whether it's a populated place or a river or a lake. And if it's on the map, we'll get back information about it. So I typed in Isla Vista, California, and here it's telling me that I've got its population, its location, zip code. I can browse a map for it. I can look it up, its census files from two different censuses, and so on. Sometimes you'll get multiple matches, so the same place name might appear in multiple states, or you might get the same name appearing in compound ways in several different communities, and you have to choose which is the one that you want. The U.S. Geological Survey runs something called the National Map Viewer. This is actually a version behind now. They've got a new version out. And the National Map Viewer is a web tool that allows you to query all of the publicly available spatial information, all the map information in the United States. From this, we can go out to the online map store, the U.S. Topo, and download any one of the topographic maps. We've already met that capability. But this simply allows you to pick which theme you're interested in over here. Like this is data from NOAA, transportation information, and so on. And then decide what you're going to display on a particular map. You can zoom in, zoom out, locate, and then when you've got exactly what it is you want, you just click on a download button, and that allows you to download the information to put in your particular computer to start viewing or working. Okay, for doing place name searches, this is where it can be done. You're probably using these without realizing it every time you're looking something up on the internet through a service. The one I just showed you was the Census Bureau's one. I mentioned the Board on Geographic Names. They have absolute authority over place names. You can't just arbitrarily name a street for yourself in the U.S. You have to go through the Board on Geographic Names. USGS has something called the Geographic Names Information System, which has the name of not just every town, but literally every single feature, every creek, every road, every lake, every hill that appears on the map is also in this database. I mentioned the national map, and the last one here, the GeoNet server, is operated by the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, and their responsibility is all of the rest of the world other than the United States. So they maintain this enormous database of literally millions of place names in several different languages that you can query and look for every occurrence of, as I did this morning, every place in the world called Paris. And there were quite a lot, about 30 of them, I think. If we go to the Census Bureau itself, the Census has, this is census.gov. If we go there, there are a lot of tools that allow you to make simple maps, actually just over the internet. So in this case, I went to Isla Vista and I said, get me the most recent data you have about, I think these are rents. Oh yeah, no, this is percentage of households that are renters. So the darker the green, the higher the percentage of renters. And as you can see, Isla Vista comes out there rather prominently in the area surrounding Goleta Slough. So you can do simple thematic mapping online using the census data, very easy, and just either snapshot the result or save it onto your system. Increasingly, we're seeing the ability of websites and web applications to track you when you're surfing the web. So all the time when you're surfing the web, your URL is being tracked by often spyware and stuff like that. But if you're visiting a site, that site knows that you've just hit and can store the sites and reverse engineer, actually just read backwards up the URL, you can figure out where that person is, or at least which country they're in. And that allows you to have things like real-time maps that update and put a dot where every map web user is at any given time. And these are kind of interesting to watch over as time sequences to see. You know, you can see the whole world waking up in the morning and using the internet and so on as the Earth rotates. So just a bit of a sort of tour of some of the available facilities somewhat in the time that's left. Google Earth and Google Maps support this feature called My Maps, which allows you to set up a service on Google servers, which can then be accessed by people that you're staying in touch with, or search generally. Here's an example where I believe this is about 2 or 3 years ago. This was the Sedgwick fire. Anybody remember the date on that? There's got to be a date here somewhere. Doesn't say. But this is a time when there were fires burning all over Southern California, and people were noting them and recording through this single Google My Maps site where they were seeing fires within the community. So we had a sort of real-time map that was being supplied, not coming from the fire service or the state. It's coming from people who are just looking out the window and reporting the fires. I believe I've mentioned this in class before, but I'll go through it again. OpenStreetMaps is probably the best-known example of what's called volunteered geographic information. OpenStreetMaps was started by two guys in the UK who didn't like Crown copyright on maps. They thought that maps should be in the public domain. So they set up a user interface, this is it, very simple, and allowed people who had GPS traces from their cars or their bikes to upload those tracks. They wrote some software that read all of the tracks and processed them very quickly, and then continuously updated the world's roadmap from the data stream that was coming in. If you go up, there's a tab up here of just GPS traces. It's called User Dialogues and Traces now. You can go to that tag and kind of like watching Foursquare. You can see the immediate posts coming in of, you know, somebody that's just going home from work in Germany posts their log home, and you know, there's somebody in South America, and the stream of data keeps coming in. Every time somebody drives another street, the world roadmap gets a little bit better. So here's Santa Barbara and Isla Vista and Goleta in October 2007, and I've been tracking it on a regular basis ever since. Here it is in October 2008. People have filled in all the details of the roads. We're beginning to get people adding information like parks. Here it is in October 2010, beginning to get really quite useful. In fact, it's now more detailed than the topographic map from the USGS. Even things like trails. So this is a park where I hike most of the time, Ealing's Park, and somebody's taken their GPS receiver, probably put it on their bike while they've been mountain biking, and logged every one of the trails in the park. Interesting story about this image. Around about this time, there was an effort underway to map under-reported parts of the world, or places that are not necessarily mapped, to map them voluntarily. And they call these things crisis workshops, where when something happens bad, like, say, the Port-au-Prince earthquake, people get together very quickly and have a sort of mapping party. Many of the imaging agencies will provide imagery for free. You can digitize maps off of that. OpenStreetMap actually has now several tools that allow you to digitize and capture street information by hand rather than having to drive it with GPS, and you can check that in. Well, we ran a crisis workshop here at UCSB in the Spatial Center for the Haiti earthquake, and we had so many volunteers show up, a lot of them were sitting around with nothing to do, so they said, why don't we map Isla Vista? So I would argue that Isla Vista is better mapped in OpenStreetMap than probably any other community in the country. Google has gone one step further in Google Maps. Increasingly, Maps and Earth are becoming synchronized now that they're going over to server side rather than having to install the software, say for Google Earth on your computer. They've incorporated this thing called Google Street View, whereby, I forgot to bring my picture of it, but there are these Google cars or even Google bikes that have basically a stick coming out of the roof of the car with cameras, a whole array of cameras looking out in different directions. And these things drive along the streets, recording their location with GPS, and then photographing all around. So if we go into Google Street View, and to do that, you just go over here by the legend, once you're down to the street level, and there's a little man here, you just grab him and drag him onto the map wherever you want to see from, and then you get these lines and arrows and things which allow you to pivot around and see the photos in any given direction. So you can actually look around. This is just on the edge of campus in IV, looking towards the campus. But you can pretty much do this anywhere in the country. About a year ago, Google asked permission to come onto campus and digitize parts of the campus as well. So we're beginning to see individual points and some of the roads appearing on the campus in Google Street View as well. This time they didn't have that. Here's just another view. We're out on Lagoon Road here, looking towards the Bren School. Google Earth and Bing Maps, many other agencies, also support three-dimensional viewing on their maps. So if you go into buildings mode and turn buildings on or turn 3D on Google Earth, you'll see things in 3D. If you go onto the campus, you'll see that a whole bunch of the buildings on campus appear in 3D. And the reason for that is that our class in geography, 176C, which we teach in the spring quarter, for several years has been in the business of digitizing the footprints of the buildings from their blueprints, creating three-dimensional models, usually in a software tool called SketchUp, which is also owned by Google, and then posting the buildings back into their correct three-dimensional location within the landscape. And that's very important because you don't want them to hover above the ground. You want them to sit quite firmly on the ground. So most of the campus buildings are, or most of the bigger buildings we've already done, but you see that much of the world is still flat. Like there's a building that didn't get 3D'd. How do you get the exteriors? Well, usually what we do is like get up on a roof and take one photo and then take that same texture and just color it over the whole roof. Just repeat the photo. Same thing goes for the side of the buildings. Photograph one piece of the front and then just clone it over and over again to be the entire front. The department is in on the Act 2. The project, again, that came out of our 176 series classes for the interactive campus map is now supported largely by undergraduates working for pay and sometimes for units within the department. We produced the first map largely out of the classes that we teach, but now this has become the campus map that's used for pretty much everything. A recent feature that's been added is this building and room finder. So here I looked up Harold Frank Hall, room 1104, and that little rectangle appeared to show me exactly where we are right now. Lots of other neat things on there too, where the recycling collection points are, handicapped access points, parking, with all the parking rules and regs and so on. This is something that has been devised as an experiment here in the department that has been running now for probably 6 or 8 months. What we're trying to do is do research on how people contribute information to these voluntary sites. So we've actually now got 4 different environments. They're all under the same URL. It's called idmapthat.org. So if you go to that location, you'll see we have one called Campus Memories, where you can simply go to places on the campus and leave a note there saying that something particular happened at that particular spot. People, you know, record where they were hit by a bike or where they fell off their skateboard. This one is about biking, so it's particular to the bike paths, and you can leave, you know, bike path really needs repair right here, that kind of thing. This one is about wireless reception, so if you're using wireless anywhere on campus and you think you've got a particularly good or a bad signal, you can post that location on the campus, so we're building a sort of map of the strength of the wireless network on the campus directly through this website. This is a new one, it just came about. We've I won't tell you, well, it's no secret. We've actually got 2 versions of this site running on 2 different systems. One's an open source server delivery software, one is proprietary from a major corporation in California. And we're looking at how the networks develop in these two different environments. This is the latest one, is Travel Tales. You can put locations of where you saw things or where you went and what's interesting in your travels around the world. Okay, so in terms of summary, I think I'm a few minutes, I'm pretty much on time. So I present to you today location-based services, a new industry that supports a new type of navigation. We've talked about practical navigation, getting yourself around, but as you can see, getting around in the real world and getting around on the internet are increasingly becoming the same thing because of things like RFID and GPS technologies. Services on the web can be push or pull. They can be throwing stuff at us that we may or may not be able to choose to get. Or we can request it when we want it. So show me the nearest pet shop is a good example of a pull request. The technologies, lots of them, GPS, RFID, mobile computing, developments in computing, and in cell phones and wireless technology, these have all been necessary applications. Web-based applications, we've gone from very few to an enormous number in a very short space of time. And things like Foursquare on the internet, which used to be sort of whoever heard of that, are creeping their way. Now I see their logo appearing in a lot of different social networking sites. So it's obvious that spatially enabled web activities is kind of the next big thing. Place names are critical here. So, and the critical link is between the place name and the coordinates associated with that place. And I've showed a couple of examples of this. There's a company called Metacarta on the internet that produces software that crawls through the internet looking for HTML pages that contain place names, and then it geocodes those place names and posts the information back onto your website. So without realizing it, you're suddenly getting geotagging happening to pretty much everything. And the web itself has led to this concept of volunteer geographic information, which has become a major research theme, not just here at UCSB, but all over the country and within the discipline of geography. Okay, that's a wrap for this one. We'll convene again on Monday. Remember, next week is week 5. We will be having a midterm examination 1 week from today.
Speaking of, should we discuss the procedure for that?
We should. Let me just turn this off.